Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
The evolution of where milk is based has been interesting over the past 20 years as well.
Nate Donne is a dairy specialist with StoneX.
They used to build plants where the milk is, and now they build plants where they want to plant, and the dairy farms build up around them. So we're currently in the largest expansion in cheese capacity that we've ever seen, with a new plant in Kansas, with a new plant in Texas, some expansions in South Dakota, Minnesota, and New York. And that's really where we're seeing the milk production growing. Texas is growing 6 to 8% on their milk production the last couple of months. Kansas is up in a similar range. South Dakota's been growing at 7 to 9%. So we're seeing a lot of milk production growth near new dairy plants.
This is Agriculture Today.
It's going to be a while before we get things resolved with China. I still cautiously optimistic we'll have an agreement because their economy is suffering. And I think they're willing to get an agreement that lasts during the Trump years, but I think it may take 6 months to a year.
Arlen Suderman is with StoneX.
Mexico and Canada are so crucial to us, especially Mexico, top buyer of U.S. corn, buy about 1 billion bushels of corn from the United States, number one buyer of pork, buy a lot of soybeans, a lot of soy meal. I mean, I could go on and what they buy from us. So the real key was, you know, how's that going to be affected? I felt like we would get an agreement pretty quick. I've been impressed with President Sheinbaum's approach to President Trump. I felt like they would be able to work something out, and I felt like Trump set the tariff at 25% that Mexico really couldn't afford, nor could they afford to counter tariffs on our food-based commodities because of the food inflation that would create. So at least we now have another pause, and I think eventually we'll be fully worked out.
We've already seen, though, an increase in future prices for oats and lumber.
Ethanol's a big one in ag as well. They're our number one importer of ethanol. And I think we will get something worked out with ethanol because Canada's economy is weak enough. 25% tariff would really do a lot of damage to their economy. But I think it's going to take longer. I think their government is less organized right now in responding to it. And I think that's going to take a little bit longer, not as long as China by any means. So I do think that we'll move to an agreement at some point, maybe over the coming weeks. But it's going to take longer than Mexico.
But will China ever be China again?
Glad you asked that question, because no, I don't think so. We even go back to Trump 1.0. They were moving away from the United States. And why is that? The biggest reason is currency exchange rates. Now, it'd be naive to say that geopolitical risks don't exist. They have stated they want to topple the United States as being the top economy and the top military in the world. They see that as intertwined. They want to displace the dollar as the global currency. They want to do all that. They've stated that. So why would they send their revenues here to support us when they want to topple us? Yes, that's true. But frankly, from a currency exchange rate, if products are available in Brazil and Argentina, Ukraine, they're going to be cheaper than what they are from the United States. So they buy from those places first and then buy the rest of what they need from the United States. And the more that encourages expansion of production in Brazil, for example, and we heard here from one of our representatives, one of our people in Brazil, that just looking at pasture land, if you convert 40% of the better pasture land to cropland, that's about 160 million acres that they can still expand. About 50% of their current production they can increase yet. Tremendous expansion capacity. So China was moving that way anyway.
So if China will never be what it once was, where can the U.S. find a partner or partners?
I was on a strategic planning task force for U.S. Soybean Export Council, I think it was a couple years back, and I said, need to be looking at other sources, and they are looking at other sources like Africa, et cetera. But that also puts that much more important on our domestic biofuel program, which lacks any type of clarity right now. And I think that's largely because it hasn't been high on the priority list for Trump administration. And when he posted on social media here in recent days that the American farmer, and stated in his address to Congress, American farmer needs to be prepared to sell a lot more domestically. The only thing I can think of that would really help fill that would be the biofuel program. So hopefully we'll get some commitment on that in the days ahead to really put his support behind the biofuel program.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The status quo is really, you know, what we've been living with since 2018. Particularly for crop insurance, there's nothing really changing in terms of the statute for crop insurance.
University of Illinois farm policy expert Jonathan Kappas.
In terms of ARC PLC, the agriculture risk coverage and price loss coverage, the primary row crop payment programs, again, this isn't a status quo scenario. It's extended for the 2025 crop year. In sign up, you'll be making that same decision as always between the two programs. Probably the one thing of note, and this is in the second line here, the reference prices. So if you recall in 2018, the Farm Bill added this escalator provision, which allows the reference price to move up if prices were high enough in the previous few years. And we're seeing that kick in. And we've talked about this a few times before. The escalator provision should move the corn reference price to 426, the soybean reference price to 926, and wheat to 556 for the 2025 crop year. So as you make your decision for this coming crop year on the programs, you'll want to factor this in. Remembering that it's that reference price, even if this elevated amount, you know, you've got to have a 12-month marketing year average price that falls below it to trigger the payment, whereas the ARC program is that price yield revenue calculation using the five previous years as a benchmark and set at 86% of that benchmark. And so that moves a lot more. But we've seen this increase. We've seen that provision from 2018 already kicking in on the three major crops and raising those reference prices. Conservation programs, again, mostly status quo, but the certainty, I would say we have less certainty overall given what's happened with the IRA funding and the focus on these kind of programs and whether they end up also falling into one or the other cutting spending reduction efforts at the administration or congressional level. Just note that overall, those are authorized through 2031, so there's actually not an extension issue with them, and so those could continue for the next few fiscal years. But that all obviously depends on the funding situation. And like I said at the beginning, we're in this kind of limbo state with the Inflation Reduction Act funding, in which a federal judge has ordered that those funds be unfrozen. But it, by all reporting, those funds have remained frozen for those conservation practices and the Climate Smart Partnerships as well, research funding and others that are still caught up in the funding freeze issue. So that's kind of where we're at. If we take all of that and try to make us an outlook out of it, we might try to handicap the farm bill. And I mean, the bottom line is it doesn't look good, at least for a regular farm bill process, in this year. Reconciliation right now is looking like a lock, presuming that, both chambers can agree to a budget resolution that includes the instructions. At $230 billion in instructed cuts, or even somewhere short of that, it's almost a lock as well that the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, will be cut in that process and included in that process, which may to some degree decouple it or take it out of the farm bill. I don't know yet how that's going to look. We know they're looking for trillions in offsets, so that a program like SNAP is going to clearly be on the menu of items they look at, which leaves vast uncertainty for whatever's left of the farm bill or everything else that's left of the farm bill or whatever is left of the congressional calendar to try to reauthorize a farm bill. So our uncertainty is just at an absolute all-time extreme in terms of not knowing how this is going to play out.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The potential economic benefit of looking at our feedstuffs per unit of nutrient that they contain, as opposed to just looking at that cost on a price per ton basis.
Oklahoma State beef breeding specialist, Dr. Mark Johnson.
Right now, at the time we tape, we could buy 38% range cubes at about $475 a ton, bulk price, or 20% range cubes at about $350 a ton, bulk price. Now, again, that's the moment we're taping. We know these prices vary from week to week, month to month, and year to year. Obviously, it looks more appealing to be buying those range cubes at $350 a ton than it does $475. But actually, based on our specific target that we're shooting for from a nutritional standpoint, one or the other of these options may be a little bit better if we break down these feed costs on a price per unit of either crude protein or the energy that they contain. Both of these range cubes are about 70% TDN. What does that mean to us? The energy content in either one is about the same. So if we're needing an energy feed, we'll take a look at that cost. If we're actually needing a protein supplement, we'll take a look at that cost. So looking at these step by step, 38% range cubes at $4.75 a ton, that means that these protein contents are given on an as-is basis. That ton of range cubes containing 38% crude protein has actually got 760 pounds of crude protein that we're buying. At 70% TDN, taking a look at the energy content, we're buying 1,400 pounds of energy per ton of those range cubes. So what does this equate to? If we take a look at these prices per unit of nutrient, take our $475 price per ton, divide it by the 760 pounds of protein that we're getting, and that works out to a cost of about 62.5 cents per unit of crude protein that we're purchasing in those 38% cubes. By that same token, the $475 per ton price divided by 1,400 pounds of energy works out to a price of about 34 cents per pound of total digestible nutrients, our expression of energy for the sake of the example we're working through. We take a look at those 20% cubes and do the same math. 20% cubes are going to have 400 pounds of crude protein per ton, 1,400 pounds of TDN. TDN content of both these is the same. So our per unit cost, $350 a ton price divided by 400 pounds of crude protein, is a per pound cost of about 87.5 cents if we're looking at that by crude protein content. The energy content, $350 divided by the $1,400 of energy, we're at about 25 cents per pound of TDN that we're buying in those 20% cubes. So at this point, we can ask ourselves, well, what is actually the better buy here? And that depends entirely upon our feeding objective. We know that cows, calves, all different ages, stages of production, their energy and their protein requirements change. So next week, we're actually going to take a look at this relative to a specific feeding goal. But what we can answer for right now is that the energy purchase in the 20% cubes looks more cost effective. The protein content per unit is more cost effective in the 38% cubes, looking specifically at the cost per unit of protein versus the cost per unit of energy.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Specialty crops represent nearly half the total U.S. farm gate crop value, yet they receive less than 1% of farm bill funding. We would urge investments in research and development for increased yield, sustainability, mechanization, and automation, expanded crop insurance.
Testifying before a Senate Ag Committee, Brett Erickson, an Edinburgh, Texas vegetable grower.
Texas produces nearly 65 specialty crops. We have insurance programs for three. Market development support to stabilize pricing and competitiveness, and federal procurement reform to increase specialty crop purchases.
But to get to a new farm bill, we're also dealing with reconciliation. University of Illinois farm policy expert Jonathan Kappas.
Now, this isn't the first time we've been through this, so just sort of a brief history detour, if you will. The first time we ever saw this kind of reconciliation process was in 1991. That nearly derailed the farm bill in 81. You know, it was the first time it was turned against that, and we had this wonderful little fight over farm bill spending, including the creatively named bullweevil Democrats who cut a deal with then-President Reagan to protect farm support payments. And that eventually allowed the farm bill to move through. 1990 then was the next go-around in which reconciliation impacted the farm bill. This is when we cut the amount of farm program payments that a farmer received, moving them down to this 85% of the acres. At that time, they were called base acres, but they were still coupled to planting. And this obviously still carries through today. We make payments on 85% of the base acres of a crop. 1995-96 then produced the 1996 Farm Bill, which fully decoupled farm program payments at the time. But that all began with a massive reconciliation effort in 1995. This would be the so-called Republican Revolution in the House, led by Newt Gingrich, who was then Speaker, or became Speaker of the House in the 1994 midterm elections. And they came at everything. I mean, they were seeking to cut farm programs, food stamps, the women, infants, and supplemental assistance to women, infants, and children, the school lunch program. I mean, they had this massive reconciliation effort. It went nowhere because President Clinton at the time vetoed that, forcing a government shutdown. But our farm bill eventually, while it was included in the reconciliation package, eventually passed on its own in this late winter and early spring of 96. But obviously drastically changed farm policy as a result. So we can see the impacts of reconciliation, even if the farm bill itself is not derailed by or prevented from happening under reconciliation. Then the opposite example was just a couple of years ago with the Inflation Reduction Act. Democrats, when they had a trifecta, House, Senate, and White House, used the reconciliation measure this time to increase spending across the whole range of things, mostly around renewable energy, climate change, and environmental issues. And included in that massive bill in 2022 was this $20 billion of additional funding for four conservation programs that are authorized in the Farm Bill. That would be the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, the Conservation Stewardship Program, the Regional Conservation Partnership Program, and the Agricultural Conservation Easement Program. So it's an example of a use of that process, but for a different outcome than what we're seeing in this current set of instructions, which are looking to reduce spending. That was different in 2022. And of course, in between all of this, we know that the 2014 Farm Bill was very much complicated and nearly derailed by fights over budget issues and debt ceiling. So just serving a reminder of just how much the budget fight can impact, if not completely throw off course, a Farm Bill reauthorization effort. And obviously we are in now our third extension of the 2018 Farm Bill. And so that certainly we've seen that already, and that's likely to play out even further this year.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The policy came out in the Inflation Reduction Act about 2.5 years ago. What we're still missing is final guidance on some of the rulemaking and some of the calculations on it. So that's one piece.
Jim Paroli is with StoneX talking about 45Z.
We saw a flurry of investment and interest initially when the ruling came out. There's been this lag and delay because we don't have the final ruling. The other component is that it seemed like the 3-year window from 25 to 27 or through the end of 2027 was going to be plenty of time to recoup investment, but already we're a few months into 2025. It takes a long time to get permitted. We've had delays and construction and long lead times on major equipment. And so we have a delay to get going, but we also have this short time window. So we're looking for final guidance and an extension on that time window would really help propel innovation in the renewable energy space. And that's what this policy is really designed to do, is allow all forms of renewable energy, transportation fuels to compete equally on a CI basis. And so we need more time and more clarity to allow companies to commit to those investments.
But in spite of all the dark clouds, Paroli says the future remains bright for ag.
It's going to, specifically around the clarity we're getting in the incentives around sustainable aviation fuel, that has to be produced with something coming from agriculture in the U.S. So it has to either come from vegetable oils, or it has to use alcohol as a building block to use sustainable aviation fuel. Either one of those has tremendous upside. So that, whether the farmer sees it in a direct cost or some type of a low carbon payment back to them at the farm level, or most likely in the longer term, we're going to see, increased demand for products. And we could see, corn demand increase 20, 30, almost 100% if we were to, supply all the future sustainable aviation fuel demand with ethanol.
Speaking at the recent StoneX Ag and Dairy Market Outlook in Nashville, Nate Donay is with StoneX.
The biggest change has probably been the export market. When I started in 2005, we were exporting 3-4% of our milk, and now we're exporting 16-17% of the milk. So it's really been the growth in the export market that has been, the biggest development in my career.
Donay focuses on dairy. Where's the major growth coming from?
Most of the growth has been in cheese and the byproduct from cheese, which is whey. And we've found ways to break apart that whey into different products, into protein products like whey protein isolate and into carbohydrate products like lactose and permeate. And it's really been the entire cheese complex, whether it's the cheese itself or the whey products that have been driving a lot of the export growth.
What about prices?
We've seen a significant drop for dairy prices, well, basically all the different dairy prices in the past 2 weeks. And it's tough in the moment to disentangle how much of that is domestic demand, how much of it is production growth, and how much of it is tariff related. But I think we have a little bit of all three going on right now with milk production in California bouncing back from bird flu, with the threats of tariffs and retaliatory tariffs making people nervous about demand moving forward. And we've been dealing with weak domestic demand the past couple of months. So all three of them are coming together to push dairy prices lower here in late February and early March.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Well, we call it nitrate poisoning, but it's basically nitrite poisoning. So there's nitrates in almost all our forages that we feed cattle.
Kansas State veterinarian Dr. Greg Hanselcheck.
But when the nitrate level gets up too high, then the rumen bugs, they're turning nitrate into nitrite. And the nitrite is then absorbed out of the rumen into the bloodstream. And what it does is we've got our red blood cells there that have hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is what carries the oxygen to all our tissues. So when this elevated nitrite gets into the system, it changes the hemoglobin to a product we call methemoglobin, which cannot carry the oxygen. And so when animals become poisoned because of nitrates, it's the fact that their tissues are dying because there's not any oxygen being delivered by the red blood cells. Typically, they're just consuming too much nitrate for the bugs to utilize. And so this elevated nitrite just leaks out of the rumen into the blood system. And then these animals act like they're oxygen starved. So they might be wobbling, can't walk right, might be salivating, open mouth breathing. And then abortions. We see a lot of abortions due to nitrate poisoning. Not all forages accumulate nitrates, but a lot of our common ones do, especially like millet, any type of corn or sorghum, sorghum sedan, those kind of products, oat hay. Those are forages. If the environmental conditions are correct, they will accumulate nitrates in their, particularly in their stems. And this year during the drought season, it was a perfect time for them to accumulate nitrates. The other things, times we'll see, there are weeds. There's a lot of weeds, and the number one on the list is Johnson grass. So anytime that we're baling hay and there's some Johnson grass in it, we're always concerned about nitrate poisoning. Last year, we monitored and look and summarize what the causes of abortion are for the samples that come through our lab. And 22% of the abortion cases that we worked up with the diagnosis were due to nitrate poisoning. And it's rare that the cows ever show that they're poisoned by nitrates. They act normal, but there's apparently enough nitrite in their system that's causing an oxygen issue with the fetus. The fetus dies and then is aborted. So it's very, very common. Strangely enough, that the sample, whether it's a dead cow, which is common for nitrate, or an aborted fetus, it's the fluid in the eye, the ocular fluid. That's where the nitrate is accumulating, and that's the test that we want. So producers can go on we have a YouTube channel, KSVDL YouTube. We've got a channel on there, a little short two-minute video that shows producers how to take the proper sample of the eye from aborted fetus or whatever. So there isn't any reason why they can't collect that sample on their own. This fluid is pretty, with nitrates in it, is pretty stable for 48 hours. So as long as you can get it collected within 48 hours, if it's going to be delayed getting it to us, just freeze that sample, put it in a sterile tube of some type, and then freeze it and then send it to us. The classical sign before death is that their blood will be brown, and they call it chocolate blood. And that's just because oxygenated blood is very red, and this blood's not carrying oxygen, so it's brown. But I can tell you that it's rare that we see live animals with nitrate poisoning. Usually they're dead when they're found by the producer. But if they do notice, and it just so happens that they can look at the blood, and that's typically what veterinarians will do, that's the classical sign. There is one treatment called methylene blue, where if you give the solution IV very slowly, and a veterinarian would have to do this, but if you catch them early, it does help them. The downside is that the slaughter withhold on that compound is extremely long, talking a year or two before those animals can actually be sold for slaughter. Just from the treatment itself. So prevention is always the key for this.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
D3 or D4, extreme to exceptional drought.
Looking at exceptional drought, USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
Most of that higher-end drought is focused across the western half of the country. There's only one eastern state, and that is New Jersey, with any remaining D3. 23% of New Jersey currently covered by extreme drought or D3. At the same time, we have a large list of states across the Great Plains and the West where we see drought coverage of D3 or worse. At this point, leading the list is Arizona. We have seen rapid expansion and intensification of drought. Now, 55% of Arizona on March 4th covered by extreme to exceptional drought. Other states with double-digit numbers for D3 to D4 coverage in early March include Nevada at 20%, Texas 17%, Wyoming 16%, California 15%, and New Mexico at 14%.